This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, November 19th, 2020 on 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Today's show addresses the rise in COVID-19 cases in Arkansas and an effort to battle racism. We start with Arkansas's rising COVID-19 numbers. The state is at a pandemic high for active cases, hospitalizations from the disease, and daily numbers for deaths and new cases continue to surge. As those cases continue to climb, the governor has assembled a winter COVID-19 task force that met for the first time this week. One of the people on that task force is Larry Shackelford, the president and CEO of Washington Regional Medical System in Fayetteville. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek yesterday afternoon.
Can you describe the current patient capacity situation in our regional hospitals and how it compares to what we saw a few months ago in the spring and summer when there were also a lot of cases in Benton and Washington counties?
Absolutely. One thing that I want everyone to know is Northwest Arkansas hospitals do have capacity. We can take care of COVID patients. We can take care of the other core business that we do. But what I would share with you is that things the last week to 10 days are different. We have seen in our region approaching 90 inpatients that are COVID positive. That's about a 40 to 50% increase over where we were, just a week to 10 days ago, where we were in the mid to upper 50s. So while we have adequate room and capacity to take care of COVID and non-COVID, something that concerns me is earlier this summer, Northwest Arkansas was surging, but we really didn't see that in other parts, in the central or the northeast region. And it certainly over the last week to 10 days feels different to me now, because we're not only seeing surge in Northwest Arkansas, but in most all areas of our state.
So how is the hospital and its regional partners, and sounds like its state partners, how are you all preparing for the post-holiday winter season when we've heard a lot of predictions that cases are bound to surge and consequently, that could lead to more hospitalizations?
Yes, you're right. Coming into this time, what we typically see is people gathering in groups, multiple families and big groups. I think the nature of it being winter, it's dark earlier. We tend to do more inside gatherings. And so I really believe this next 2 to 4 weeks is important, and we need to be diligent. With that said, ever since this began, there's been really good interaction and all of the health systems in Northwest Arkansas meet frequently. Just this last week, our business leaders, our nursing leaders, our chief medical officers met, and we've been very intentional to be sure if one system is seeing a surge and another system has room or capacity, then we be sure that those patients can be taken care of here in Northwest Arkansas. There is an opportunity, I think, to be able to expand that, to look at sharing more timely information and taking a more of a statewide approach. So that's one piece. The other thing I think that we're doing, and something we do every day, is looking to be sure we have adequate PPE, to be sure we have adequate access to testing. And for those patients that need inpatient care, knowing if they're COVID positive quickly is important. And so working to be sure we have those testing supplies. And then, probably what concerns me most is being sure we have adequate staff and are giving our staff the tools. This has been a very long 8 months, and so being sure that those workers that are on the front line have the tools and the supplies and the support that they need is very important.
You are also on the governor's winter COVID-19 task force, which met for the first time this week. What kind of role are you going to play in that group?
So, you know, first, it's an honor. I think I'm glad that we have health leaders across the state that are meeting cooperatively with Arkansas Department of Health and other governmental leaders. So, you know, first to be able to be a part of the delegation and to represent, I think, not only Washington Regional, but all of the health systems and practices and doctors and providers in the region is important. And it's a responsibility that I don't take lightly. That first meeting was really to go through, you know, the charge, kind of the issues that the governor lined out when he did the order, and there are going to be four different subcommittees that will each focus on one of those issues that he identified. I've been asked to chair the subcommittee that's talking about what are practical things we can do to manage COVID. How do we keep the current pace of spread from really going down that path? So you know, that will give me an area to focus. There's a combination of other healthcare leaders from North Central and Northeast Arkansas, as well as I mentioned, leaders from Arkansas Department of Health working with us on that topic.
And what are the other three subcommittees on that task force other than the one that you're on?
Yes. So, you know, as I mentioned, when the governor did his executive order, there were kind of four topics that were outlined. The first topic is how do we coordinate beds, hospital access across all of Arkansas? That ties in, you know, to one of the things that we talked about. This second group is looking at what resources do hospitals, nursing homes, other institutions need. And those resources include staffing, personal protective equipment, testing supplies, and those sorts of things. The next group is going to be looking at what are some of the current mandates, the mask mandate, other Arkansas Department of Health directives, and what are ways that we can get good compliance with those mandates. And then the last item, again, and the group that I'll be working with is when we look at what the rate of increase, how this spread of COVID is happening, what are those best practices, and maybe what are some new guidance or some new directions that we could have moving forward.
And as I mentioned, you all are just getting started, but what kind of information will be important to you to consider at these meetings, and also if there's going to be any decision making that takes place?
It's going to be important from my perspective that we get good data. You know, we need to really look at what the data is telling us, and the importance of using data in making those decisions is important. You know, the other thing that I am encouraged about is there is broad geographic folks from across Arkansas, and I think there's some things in Northwest Arkansas we've done well, and I'm anxious to be able to share how working with other health systems, working with our Northwest Council, some success of trying to get business leaders and health leaders and our mayors and our judges all together and look at things on a regional basis. So I think that's the best practice we've done in Northwest Arkansas, and I can share that. But I'm also looking forward to what's happened in Northeast Arkansas and Central Arkansas. And so it's going to be important to me, I think, as we're making decisions to take that input and to listen to what has worked in other areas, and sometimes listen to what's not worked. And then hopefully by everyone coming together, sharing what's worked and what's not worked, then we can make a path forward.
From your perspective as a hospital administrator, are there any misconceptions that people might have about how this virus is impacting Northwest Arkansas that maybe isn't obvious unless you're on the inside?
You know, one thing I would tell you is everyone is getting tired. You know, you hear about the concept, you know, COVID fatigue, and I think it's real. You know, there's probably not one single answer, right? There's not this magic rabbit that we're going to pull out of the hat to make this go away. I am optimistic. I think some of the information on the vaccine trials that's come out even this week is positive. And so, you know, I would truly encourage us to really think like we did in the spring, you know, when it was new and when there was really a heightened anxiety, because even though the message hasn't changed, you know, we still, you know, need to wash our hands and we still need to wear a mask and to watch our distance that we are from each other. And that message, it gets kind of old, right? I mean, it hasn't changed, but as people get tired, it's really important that we stay diligent. And, you know, even our workforce, you know, we're at work and it's easy because everybody's wearing their mask and we're meeting virtually, but it's not as easy that night. It's not as easy when you get home. It's not as easy when friends or family call and we want to get back to like what life was like before. And so maintaining that balance and doing those things that we need to do is really important, in my opinion.
And with all these holidays coming up, with Thanksgiving next week and then Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, then there's New Year's Eve, there's New Year's Day, just this slew of holidays coming up. What do you want people to keep in mind? And I know we've been hearing this a lot, but I think this question is still an important one to ask.
Oh, I absolutely think it is. And you know, the concern that I have for the next 2 to 4 weeks is very worrisome. You know, I can tell you that even within our family, you know, we've had to have some, you know, some tough talks, and you know, those guidelines of not gathering in groups of more than 10, not more than two different households gathering, is going to make Thanksgiving next week very different for us, and it's hard. And you know, we do have much to be thankful for, and we want to respect how we have done things in the past, but it is important. And you know, as I look back and looked at what happened following 4th of July, what happened with Labor Day, you can almost go back to the calendar and look at inpatient, you know, patients that are requiring that higher level of care. And about 2 weeks after each of those holidays, it increased. And as you mentioned, 2 weeks after Thanksgiving is when some of these other things start happening. And then 2 weeks after that, New Year starts happening. So you're right. It's probably not a message that is different than what other public health officials are saying, but But I would just say, you know, being diligent, being cautious, and not just doing it for your protection, but those others in your family, I think is very important.
And my last question for you is, if there's anything else that you think listeners in this region need to know about their hospital systems?
Yeah, you know, on top of taking care of and seeing COVID patients, we're really seeing a lot of sick non-COVID patients. It's fortunate flu right now doesn't seem to be rampant, and so we're not dealing with that. But a message that I would want your listeners to understand is, ever since there have been hospitals, taking care of infectious patients is what we've done, and what we're seeing is people that are seeing those symptoms. They know something's not right. They're feeling some chest pain. And instead of doing what they might have done pre-COVID, is go to the ER and seek help, they wait. And unfortunately, sometimes they wait to the point that the outcome is not as good as it might otherwise have been. So this message is hard. You know, we say on one hand, if you're sick, stay home, right? I mean, if it's allergies, but what I would tell you, if there's something going on, don't wait. You can come to ERs, to primary care clinics, and they are safe, and you're going to have a much better outcome seeking care on a timely basis.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. I know everyone who works at hospitals right now is very busy.
Well, thank you.
Larry Shackelford is president and CEO of Washington Regional Medical System. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek yesterday afternoon and is on the governor's winter COVID-19 task force. He says the task force and its subcommittees will likely meet every week. Also happening this week, nearly 300 Arkansas doctors signed a letter to Governor Asa Hutchinson urging him to do more to stop the spread of COVID-19. In response, the governor wrote his own open letter stating he shares the commitment to slowing the spread of the virus and will continue to be guided by the expertise of public health officials.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Penguin Ed's BBQ, open for curbside pickup 7 days a week at the Mission and Crossover location in Fayetteville, and open 7 days a week with dine-in, patio, and curbside pickup at the historic B&B location. PenguinEds.com for menus and more.
This is Ozarks at Large. Tonight at 6, KUAF and the Fayetteville Public Library host the second of four public discussions connected to our podcast series, The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas. We'll begin at 6. The discussion is free and open to the public. You do need to register for the Zoom link at faylib.org. In advance of tonight's discussion, here is the second episode of The Movement That Never Was.
At the beginning of September, Stephanie Isaacs announced her candidacy for a city council seat in Shelbyville, Tennessee. It's a small city about an hour south of Nashville. Its claim to fame is an annual walking horse festival. But it's becoming a place where people priced out of Nashville come to find an affordable place to live. So it's a fairly working-class city. About half the population are renters. And that includes a growing number of asylum seekers and refugees from places like Somalia and Guatemala. Stephanie is one of those renters. She's white. She's working class. She's in her late 20s, and this was her first ever run for office. Stephanie didn't come out of the blue.
Stephanie Isaacs is the founder of the Bedford County Listening Project, a 10-month walking survey of more than 230...
She's been a leader in a mostly white tenants' rights group for the past 3 years. She's gone door to door in decaying apartment complexes. She's been a formidable presence at public meetings, and she's made plenty of enemies among the city's landlords. And if we zoom out a bit more, Stephanie is part of a white anti-racist organizing tradition that goes back a long way in the South, one that has appeared time and time again in poor and working class communities. But almost every time a movement like that starts to form, it hardly makes it out of its infancy. And why is that? Well, the short answer is that solidarity is fragile, and especially when whiteness is involved. But even if it only shows up in fits and starts, there is no version of white anti-racism with deeper roots in the South than working-class solidarity. So let's try to get a sense of what it's looked like in the past 60 years. From KUAF Public Radio, and with funding from the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, I'm Paul Kiefer, and this is The Movement That Never Was, a people's guide to anti-racism in the South and Arkansas. If you listen to the first episode of this series, you'll know the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. You'll also know that SNCC voted to become an all-black organization in 1967, and you'll know that at least some of the former white staff went on to try organizing white people. Only a handful of them were actually from the South. But SNCC's impact on organizing in the South extended beyond its own staff. We're well aware that a lot of the civil rights movement was born on the campuses of black colleges and universities in the South. What might be less well known are the seeds the movement planted on the campuses of white colleges in the South. And the most prominent of those seeds popped up in 1964 as the Southern Student Organizing Committee, or SOC.
People like Stokely Carmichael, who had good relations with people in SOC, encouraged SOC to really stick to the white community and to the white campus. Stokely's famous phrase to the people in SOC was, "I can't organize the guys hanging around the gas station. That could only be you." So SNCC was the model.
That's Greg Michel. He's a history professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and he wrote the book on SOC. And he says that most of the group's members had worked with SNCC in some capacity, and they picked up direction and momentum from their experiences with SNCC. And with that guidance, the members of SOC set out to try to build support for anti-racism among their white peers on college campuses. But aside from the fact that some of them came from working-class backgrounds, what does any of this have to do with working-class organizing? Some of SOC's organizers wanted to look beyond the campus.
There was a segment of the group early on, especially as we get into 65, 66, that was very interested in connecting the on-campus to the off-campus, and the way to do that was through labor, through organized labor and unions. They pushed real hard to support organizing campaigns by college campus workers at places like Duke and University of North Carolina, and they got involved in textile mill organizing in North Carolina as well. I don't want to pretend it was this great success, but it reflected an orientation that said we got to move off the campus.
And why would that campaign qualify as anti-racist? Well, not all mill employees were white, and unionization would have theoretically benefited both black and white workers. So really, the campaign was partially about convincing white workers to feel a sense of shared struggle with their black coworkers. But even if a few white mill hands recognized the value of solidarity, there were two key obstacles that stopped the movement from really taking root in North Carolina mills.
It didn't go great. Aside from the, opposition of employers, they didn't win enough support from mill hands to force union votes in most cases. So why didn't mill hands and others in the mill support them? I mean, there's any number of reasons, you'd have to say race was definitely part of it.
In short, many white mill hands saw aligning themselves with black workers as a step too far, even if that meant sacrificing the benefits of unionization. That problem, white workers choosing race loyalty over class solidarity, isn't new. In fact, it's so common that there's a shorthand for it. It's often called the race bribe. Anyway, after their unionization projects fell through, SOC didn't last long. Like a lot of other civil rights groups, it fell apart in the late 1960s because of internal disagreements, a lack of resources, and the enduring hostility of the white communities they were trying to organize. But the members who wanted to remain involved in anti-racism didn't focus on keeping a spark alive on college campuses. To them, the future of anti-racism in the South was about working-class solidarity, even if that meant overcoming the allure of the race bribe.
A lot of it was personal. Which is to say, there was a segment of SOC activists who, after the group's collapse in 1969, moved into jobs in factories. They took factory jobs in southern communities because they believed that that was where the most radical potential for change in the South resided. And so they wanted to live essentially what they preached.
So let's back up a little. SOC was like a Southern corollary to a much more famous group called Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS. SDS was based in Chicago, and its members were essentially white Northern college students. But they also wanted to venture off campus. They wanted to shift the anti-racist movement from colleges to white working-class communities in the North. It just so happened that one of the big working-class white neighborhoods in Chicago was a Southern enclave called Uptown. And I'm going to turn things over to someone who lived in Uptown in the 60s and 70s to explain what happened there. His name is Hi Thurman, and he moved to Chicago from rural East Tennessee.
I was raised in, the South, extremely poor conditions, single-parent home. To a large extent, I started working and going out into the fields, working with my mother and my siblings when I was about 3 months old.
In the 1950s, a stream of poor white people from the Upper South were migrating to cities in the Midwest and the Northeast looking for work. They'd show up in Cincinnati, work for a while, move to Cleveland, work for a while more, and then go to Pittsburgh or Detroit and so on. By the time he reached his late teens, Hi decided to do the same thing.
And I finally decided that I wanted to get out. I had an older brother in Chicago.
And Hi's brother lived in Uptown. And to the rest of Chicago, Uptown had a reputation. Specifically, Uptown became a magnet for poor white Southerners like Hi and his brother. By the early 1960s, there were as many as 40,000 white Southern migrants in the city, almost all of whom congregated in Uptown.
It was pretty much run down when the Appalachians and other people from the South started moving north to find jobs because of the farms being taken over by the big conglomerates and the banks and the coal mines shutting down.
But when they arrived in Uptown, most of the migrants didn't fare any better than they had back home.
But unfortunately, when they came to Chicago, in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, there was no jobs available for their skill. You can't plant a garden on concrete, but they had no other skills. So Uptown became one of the highest unemployment areas in Chicago. Actually, at one time in the 1960s, it was 47% unemployment rate.
And even where there were jobs, migrants like Hi were often turned away by employers who looked down on them.
When I got there, I applied everywhere for a job in Chicago and got turned down by almost every one of them because I was from the South and was considered to be, a backwards hillbilly.
So Hi and other migrants were stuck doing dangerous day labor and watching employment agencies skim their wages. And this wave of migrants was continuing to pass through Chicago in the mid-1960s. And that's when Uptown caught the attention of Students for a Democratic Society.
The Students for a Democratic Society came into the community in around 1965, I think. And they came into the Uptown community because they wanted to try to find people jobs. And so what happened was they realized that jobs were not the only problems that we had in the community, that there was much more: housing issues, police brutality, nutrition.
And SDS found its greatest success in organizing a group of former gang members who had begun to turn political. They called themselves the Good Fellas, and Hi's brother was a member.
SDS was very instrumental and teaching some political ideology, also radical ideology, and also helped the Goodfellas organize a march on the local police station because of the police brutality. And so they helped organize that, but then they also helped organize, other, like, tenant unions food pantries. One of the areas that they did work into was welfare rights. They had a lot of, they tried to educate as much as they could.
But the students from SDS didn't fit perfectly into Uptown.
There was some class tension. There was some There were some students who, you know, had a little bit and flaunted it. But there were, you know, there were some that were just very, very dedicated to, you know, to helping the community and helping people. Although they were limited as far as fitting into the community.
So it became clear to High and other white Southerners who had started working with SDS that Uptown needed to start organizing for itself. And that's when they started to call themselves the Young Patriots Organization. At that point, it's 1968. As SDS and the Goodfellas were busy organizing poor white people in Uptown, other poor communities across Chicago were also starting to form anti-racist revolutionary movements. Just a few blocks away from Uptown, in a Puerto Rican neighborhood called Lincoln Park, another street gang had transformed into a leftist political group called the Young Lords. And at about the same time, a former SNCC worker named Bobby Lee Rush co-founded the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. And you probably already know something about the Black Panther Party, but let's go over some basics. The Panthers began as a group of black students at Merritt College in Oakland, California, and they were all migrants from the South. They actually got their name from an offshoot of SNCC founded in Alabama by Stokely Carmichael. And the Panthers were the most prominent product of the Black Power era, a product of the same shift in the civil rights movement that prompted SNCC to become all black. But in 1968, class struggle was front and center in their rhetoric. So in Chicago, the new Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, co-founded by Bobby Lee Rush and led by a charismatic 20-year-old named Fred Hampton, was looking to form alliances with other poor communities in the city who shared their interest in social justice and class revolution. So it was only a matter of time before they ran into the Young Patriots. And that finally happened at a fundraiser in a middle-class neighborhood on Chicago's North Side.
We really didn't know that the Black Panthers were going to be there, and they didn't know that we were going to be there. And so we kind of ended up on the same ticket. And so when we started talking about Uptown and what we were trying to raise money for, you know, to help our community, we were tongue-lashed basically by the white people about, you know, why don't you work and get off of welfare and all this stuff. Well, Bobby Lee stood up for us. You know, he stood up for us at that meeting. And he said that, you know, we're talking the same language as the Black Panthers are talking, you know. And that, you know, we all have the same problem.
There's police brutality up here. There's rats and roaches. There's poverty up here. That's the first thing that we can unite on. That's the common thing we have, man. And we can unite on poverty and unite on the concept of poverty. You know, everything becomes colors, man.
Right on. Buildings not fit for dogs to live in, but humans having to pay $144 a month for the thing. They sell the building, you know, to new ownership. What we need is understanding among the people.
Right on.
Coalition between the people to stick together.
Right on.
And take them owners and put them over here in the lake somewhere.
Right on. Right on.
And so from that point, we started, you know, we started talking with each other. And he came into Uptown. He lived there for a while. And then he thought, yeah, this might just be, you know, the area we need to go into since there's a bunch of crazy hillbillies up there on the north side talking revolution.
At least where politics were concerned, the Black Panthers and the Young Patriots seemed like a perfect match. They were both evolutions of the civil rights movement. They were both fighting for tenants' rights, against police brutality, for fair pay. But in reality, they developed separately. The Patriots developed in a community of poor white migrants from the South in which anti-black racism was widely accepted. And the Panthers developed in a community of poor black migrants from the South who had been on the receiving end of that racism for their entire lives. So when the Black Panthers, the Young Patriots, and the Young Lords, that's the Puerto Rican group I mentioned earlier, came together to form what they called the Rainbow Coalition, it took time to adjust.
It was kind of tense. You know, we had some of our people who didn't want anything to do with it. We had the people of the Young Lords. They didn't want anything to do with us. They left. The Black Panthers, some of them didn't want anything to do with us. And they left. But it was only intense for a little while. And I think it's a purge, basically, that needed to happen, you know, to get people on the same page.
The core principle of the Rainbow Coalition was solidarity. There was no defined leader. Each of the member organizations remained embedded in their own communities.
But if the Panthers or the Lords, you know, needed us to come and organize with them or go on a march or take over a building or whatever they wanted, we would come to them and strip ourselves of the Young Patriots. We would become a Black Panther.
For the most part, the Panthers, the Young Lords, and the Patriots just kept doing what they were doing. They helped each other set up free medical clinics. They provided breakfast to school kids and seniors. They led protests against slumlords, and they took in and helped rehabilitate former drug users. And actually, within the first year of the coalition, they ran a presidential campaign. The Panthers provided the candidate for president. He was Eldridge Cleaver, an Arkansan and the party's national secretary.
They wanted someone like a white person to run as vice president, and so they came to Uptown and asked, and then we had identified Peggy Terry, who was a poor welfare mother, but also a former Klan member, and she had also had some work with SNCC, and it was called the Cleaver Terry presidential campaign.
But this was the late 1960s. The FBI was ramping up its harassment of civil rights groups, and Chicago was under the control of Mayor Richard Daley, the head of a political dynasty notorious for giving not-so-tacit support for horrifying police brutality.
I was disappointed to know that every policeman out on the beat was supposed to use his own decision. In my opinion, he should have had instructions to shoot arsonists and to shoot looters.
And the Rainbow Coalition was squarely in the sights of the FBI, the Chicago Police Department, and Mayor Daley.
Every time we would go into a building and set up the health clinic, breakfast for children program, the cop would come in and harass try to harass people, take their medications from them, you know, snatch them up and take them to jail. They'd get tested with the landlords who owned the building, and the next thing you know, would be evicted.
But the harassment wasn't just limited to arrests and intimidation.
I was taken into an alley, and hell beat out of me by two cops, kicked me. There were reports of cops pulling people's fingernails out. Fred Hampton and others had to sew their pockets shut because if they saw you going to your pocket, they can tell you you want a weapon, which gave them the opportunity to beat you or shoot you. So it was just a bad situation.
And the Chicago Police Department did eventually shoot Fred Hampton. On an early morning in December 1969, Chicago police raided Hampton's home while he lay asleep with his pregnant girlfriend. They fired through his bedroom wall, dragged him out of bed, and then executed him as he lay in the hallway.
Also, that Officer Davis may well have walked into that back bedroom, contrary to his testimony, and fired a shot into the body of Fred Hampton at one point.
So as quickly as the Rainbow Coalition picked up steam, the Chicago Police Department knocked the wind out of it. The rising threats of arrests and torture and death scared away new recruits and supporters. And to make matters even worse, the city's leadership were mounting a campaign to clear away Uptown entirely.
One of the things that Daley would do would pick a particular institution, like a university, college, whatever, and put it into these communities that were urban renewal designated communities. And so he identified a community college to go into Uptown that would be removing the biggest portion of the southern white population.
The Patriots tried to fight back. They presented the city council with a plan for a self-sustaining southern enclave they called Hank Williams Village, which they hoped would become an affordable housing development and social service hub that could take in new arrivals from Appalachia. But even after they found funding for the idea, through grants and fundraising and all of that, the Patriots didn't have a chance to save Uptown.
They turned it down and finally went to the city council, and the city council voted in, you know, the community college, which stands there now as one of Daly's legacies. And that is what changed Uptown. That's what destroyed, is pretty much what destroyed the Young Patriots.
The Patriots splintered into competing groups. Some of the old members stuck around in Chicago for a while, but without a community to organize, the Patriots couldn't exist. Similar fates befell the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, and by the early 1970s, the short-lived experiment in an anti-racist working-class solidarity movement was over. Like a lot of the other poor white Southerners who had joined the Young Patriots, High headed back south, and when he returned to Tennessee, he brought his new anti-racist political identity with him, for better and for worse.
I tried living in my hometown. I couldn't do that because everywhere I would go, I and others, the cops always knew about it, where we were, and they wanted it for years. And I had to leave my hometown because of threats and, you know, on me and my family. So I eventually wandered around the South for a long time.
High is still in the South. He's living in Huntsville, Alabama, and he's running a school for anti-racist organizers. And back in 2017, just after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, High headed just across the state line to the north to join counter-protesters at a white supremacist rally in Shelbyville. And as it so happens, that rally was also the genesis of the Bedford County Listening Project. That's the tenants' rights group that Stephanie runs. Stephanie was there.
All right. How high do you want that wall? 10 feet higher.
So walking to the rally, there were snipers on the roof of the school that you had to pass by to get in line, to get patted down because you couldn't have certain things to come into the like counter protest area. And like on our side, everybody was just, you know, supportive and, everybody on the other side was very angry. You kind of got the feeling that if something happened, the police wouldn't be on our side.
She says that in the wake of the rally, the reactions of Shelbyville residents split down class lines.
There were a lot of, working class folks were basically, like, they didn't want it, you know, they didn't want stuff like that to come back. They didn't want it to be here. A lot of the richer folks were basically like, well, I'm glad they didn't damage property. I mean, that's why, you know, we started just to see what, why people, why, you know, like other groups like that thought Shelbyville was a place to come to and to prevent it. So that's why we decided to start knocking and see what people, you know, needed or didn't need. And
when they were outdoor knocking in 2017, Stephanie and her fellow organizers had to take a leaf out of the Young Patriots' book. They wanted to win the trust of their neighbors, so they had to meet them where they were.
I mean, in that conversation we had with people, if you wanted to come door knock with us, you knew that you weren't going to go to that door and you weren't going to shame them or have a look on your face that meant you were shaming them, because people are not going to come and talk to you and tell you their problems if they don't trust you. And if you're judging them, they're not going to trust you.
To be clear, Stephanie and a few other organizers went around knocking on the doors of anyone they could find in the city. But who actually showed up when the Bedford County Listening Project started holding meetings? The person you're about to hear speak is Kelly Sue Waller. She's another organizer with the project.
People that came were a lot of single mothers. A lot of single mothers that were facing substandard housing issues, who didn't have a lot of family. Some of those people were actually ostracized from their families because they were in multiracial families.
And Kelly and Stephanie are quick to point out that most of those women are white, but they have a pretty good idea why more immigrant and refugee neighbors haven't been willing to stir the pot in a town like Shelbyville.
A lot of folks were really friendly. We had some good conversations, but basically, people said that they're afraid. They need houses. They need places to live. And that they are afraid because of the political climate. That may not be the word that was used. The political climate that people are afraid of ICE. They don't know who's knocking on their door.
And Kelly says that something similar is true in the case of non-immigrant Black neighbors. Tenants' rights work is risky, and people fear the consequences will be worse for Black renters.
Black leaders who we had connections with basically said, y'all build some power, stick your heads out, let us know what happens. And encouraged us to, yes, organize white folks. As weird as that sounds, and as much as like there's some pushback from the left around organizing white spaces, there is also a tradition and an ask of being asked to do just that, for white folks to go into their own neighborhoods and organize people.
So how do they plan to build an anti-racist movement with a room full of working class white Southerners with an array of political beliefs?
Did you know that Dale Earnhardt thought that the Confederate flag was bad because his housekeeper said she didn't like it? And did y'all know Dolly Parton just said Black Lives Matter?
And the next step, Kelly says, is focusing on the problems that led people to show up to the meeting. Bedbugs, mold, dirty water, you know, the immediate problems.
Landlords will tell renters, well, the reason there's not enough housing here is we have so many, I'm going to use the word immigrants. That is not the word that people normally use. Sometimes people say illegals. And that they're the ones who bring in the roaches and the bedbugs. And when we hear that, one thing that I've heard other renters and Stephanie say is basically like, who benefits when you believe that? Who benefits when you believe that the fault of substandard housing and lack of rental protections is the cause is like other working people? Like what, who like trying to point to the power structure that's not solving the problem rather than your neighbor.
And it's at that point, says Kelly, that she and Stephanie can start explicitly addressing the fact that meetings are overwhelmingly white.
When you have a conversation with white folks about who's in the room, then you are talking about your whiteness.
She says those conversations can't follow the standard anti-racist script.
We don't do what a lot of anti-racist middle class and upper middle class folks do. And partially that's because we're not in the same situation that upper and middle class and rich white folks are and don't have the same kind of privilege. Do we have white privilege? Yes. But it is a different white privilege when you're poor than when you're rich.
But Kelly also added that most of the people who come to the meeting don't really need to be convinced of that. A lot of the people who show up have already figured it out on their own.
We got to talk about why some people don't feel safe to call the police and report that their landlord has illegally shut their power off.
But there's a big unanswered question. Has the Bedford County Listening Project actually made any headway?
They saved 12 families from being evicted, but the first day the eviction, like the courts opened from like, what was it, like March to June, there were like 61 evictions filed.
But Kelly brought up one incident that stuck with her as a sign that their project could really live up to its anti-racist goals. She's going to reference something called TURC in a second. That's the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition. And among other things, they monitor possible anti-immigrant legislation in the state.
We were planning to release, in January 2020, we were releasing a walking survey of 250 renters that we had talked to, just like a damning report of the substandard housing issues in Shelbyville. And the day that we were doing the press release, Turk reached out and was like, hey, do you know that they're trying to pass this resolution in Shelbyville that would be non-binding, but it's harmful anyway, that says they don't want any more refugees? And we reached out to the people who were doing the press conference, which were like renters and members of the BCLP, and we were like, hey, this thing's happening today. And immediately the group was like, oh, well, we need to write that into our statements. And we made signs that were like, refugees, not slumlords. I mean, it was immediate. And for me, it was a moment for me where I was like, this is possible. Like this, you know, I mean, I wanted to believe it was possible, but it was really a moment for me where I was like, okay, this is real. Here's a group of folks who are here about their renters issue, and they hear that their town is like this certain couple of commissioners are trying to do this. And they're like, no, those are my neighbors.
Stephanie didn't go knocking on doors as an anti-racist candidate. She went out as a tenants' rights candidate. She spoke to voters' self-interest. And to her, that's the starting point. It's the starting point for pretty much every multiracial working-class solidarity movement in Southern history. But that, in and of itself, doesn't make for an anti-racist movement. And it's why so many of these movements are prone to failing. Time and time again, in Arkansas and everywhere else in the South, poor white people have joined multiracial movements to fight a shared problem. And then they walked away when they began to believe that anti-racism wasn't in their best interest. And sometimes it's inevitable. Sometimes, like in Chicago, it's police brutality. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's money. Sometimes it's political power. But it's undeniable. Self-interest is always the starting point for movements like these. It was a starting point for the Young Patriots. And it's the starting point in Shelbyville, too. But for a movement like those to have real legs, its members need to really believe in an anti-racist future. That's what Stephanie hopes she and her fellow organizers can keep alive in Shelbyville.
It's so important that we stay the path and we keep having these conversations with people about that our neighbors matter, no matter what their color are, and that everybody has can have a seat at our table, and that we are stronger that way.
So to reiterate, working class solidarity is a starting point. Race, and within that, whiteness, don't disappear when working class people band together. But the fact that someone like Hi Thurman is still out there teaching anti-racist workshops in Alabama, and the fact that the Bedford County Listening Project is finding a foothold in Shelbyville, means there's hope that white anti-racism can really take root in working class white Southern communities. And possibly more than anywhere else, those communities are ripe for creating a lasting and effective white anti-racist movement. Thanks for listening.
The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, is a production of KUAF Public Radio with support from the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation. It's written and executive produced by Paul Kiefer. Our theme music was composed by Kevin Blagg. You can learn more about this podcast series online at KUAF.com.
KUAF and the Fayetteville Public Library will host a virtual panel discussion tonight at 6 connected to what you just heard. It's free and open to the public, but does require registration for the Zoom link. That can be found at the library's website, faylib.org.
KUAF is supported by Park Lane Family Dental, offering dental wellness with an emphasis on restorative and cosmetic dentistry. Located in the area for more than 30 years with offices in Fort Smith and Rogers, and now in Springdale. Park Lane follows CDC-recommended protocol for COVID prevention. ParkLaneDental.com for information or to schedule an appointment. Theater Squared presents The Half-Life of Marie Curie, featuring science, scandal, comedy, and heart as it profiles two rock star women scientists who bond, bicker, reconcile, share ideals, and whiskey as their work transforms their lives and the world. Filmed live at T2, streaming is available now through December 20th. 777-7477 or theater2.org. for tickets and information.
This is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Timothy Dennis produced our show today. Our thanks to Zuzana Sitek, as well as the entire team connected with the Movement That Never Was podcast. We'll be back tomorrow at noon and 7. Thanks for listening.